The World Tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
Won't it prove embarrassing to the leaders of great nations when someday they are forced to admit God exists? Can you imagine a conversation someday when that God who does exist says, "You mean to say you thought maybe I did exist and didn't go to the trouble to find out what I told you to do? You mean to say you even had a form of religion, you went to church and you talked about me, you took my name on your lips, but you never once looked into the book I gave you, telling you what you are, what everybody else is, what my purpose, my plan, my program for humanity really was all about? You never looked into that guide, which anybody needs, whether he's a farmer planting carrots, a salesman trying to sell a product, a husband and a wife living at home, or a military, in this case, that's another subject. He might have to change his job if he looked very deeply, or a leader of a great people. For that matter, not only will leaders of government be embarrassed, but maybe a lot of other people who aren't in positions of prestigious power will be embarrassed someday too when they begin to really admit, when they find out, when God shows it to them, which he will, that God does exist. Now, right now, we live in a time where people can take their time, they can study, they can think, they can research, they can argue, they can deny, they can scoff. As a matter of fact, there is a great prophecy that is being fulfilled right now around the world where people say they are great believers in uniformitarianism, that everything has been going on pretty much as it always did, in uniform patterns, that life has been laid down in fossil forms, that evolution is true, that we see very simple to very highly evolved or complex, that this took place over vast aeons of time. Now, while the Bible, while the real accurate history of the creation of the world ought to be the foundational starting point of all knowledge, not the finished product, not all knowledge, but revealed knowledge that man could not otherwise have discovered for himself, the Bible ought to be the foundational beginning point. It ought to be the point of view from which other knowledge is investigated and is tested and tried and proved. But now, what is the real starting point of that which masquerades as knowledge today in the big university? It's evolution. That's the starting point. The beginning point of all knowledge today is the idea that man is just an animal, that we evolve. That uniformitarianism, that is the gradual deposition of the strata underneath our feet and the formation of islands and of continents and of rocks and valleys, the sediments and the silts that form the vast farming areas and the topsoil that gradually builds up humus as living vegetable matter decays, that all this has been going on for aeons in pretty much the same way that it is going on today, which is a fantastic, huge lie, and your own eyes ought to tell you that when you just take a simple look at it, which we're going to do by zeroing in on just one particular aspect of something that is quite common to us all, something that has to do with some of the building materials you might be using, the fuels we burn, the oil that is derived from coal and from other sources underneath the rocks, underneath our feet, in the mantle, the crust of the earth, and which causes our rockets to, well, they're using liquid oxygen and sometimes other forms, but they used to use some of these propellants, but now our modern jet aircraft are propelled by some of these fuels, which we call fossil fuels. I've talked about this in our pollution programs in the past, talked about the burning of fossil fuels and how this adds to our pollution today. Well, when I say fossil fuels, that's exactly what coal and oils, and the bituminous coal that is the major source of the heat and the light and the energy of the world today, we call it stored sunshine. And we'll zero in on this and talk about how coal was formed. And in this, we will see an absolute proof, another of the many proofs, that there had to be great chaotic cataclysms, great catastrophes. They call them natural catastrophes. But they were enormous in global effect. And very few people seem to bother to study into these things and ask how and when. How did it happen? Evolution is the starting point of practically all that masquerades as knowledge today. Whether it's mathematics, whether it's physiology and anatomy, whether it's zoology, biology, chemistry, physics, geology, whether it's comparative anatomy or whether it's any of the, like, comparative embryology and all the various aspects of biological sciences. Evolution is used as a foundation building block, a starting point through which everything is viewed. Now, once you do that, and that's hideous bias, that's terrible prejudice. That's like having a lump on your head and getting hit with a 9-pound sledge. Somebody so absolutely dizzy that they cannot admit that there may be some other alternative. That is not scientific, by the way. You know, when people form, or they postulate, they guess, in other words, they form an idea, and they presume that idea is true, then they go out and they collect facts, or they call it data. Now, they don't even say it's a fact. You know, they say that the ball went up last time we threw it, but are we sure it's going to happen next time? They try to water it down to the point they get you believing that even gravity may not always be true. So they try to tell you there are no absolutes. But if they will admit there are such things as facts, the idea is you postulate that thus and such might be true. Then you collect data. And as you do, if it fits into your postulate, you're gradually building up a theory. That theory might eventually, if you can prove it, demonstrate it, and it always acts, become what they call a law. But while you are postulating and you're collecting data, you do collect some data or some facts that completely blast this postulate, that destroy this theory, that do not fit into this original guess, then the law of objectivity, if there is any such law to which humans feel they ought to subscribe, should demand that you alter that postulate to suit the new evidence, the new facts. But they have not done that. I'm going to show you an article in a very broad, general, you know, kind of an encyclopedia, the World Book. It's written more from a layman's point of view. It is, I think, written primarily for students of the high school and the college level, perhaps. It's not quite so technical. The articles tend to be shorter. They tend to be well illustrated. I'm not advertising that. I have, by the way, no relationship whatsoever with World Book Encyclopedia. But I want to show you, even at that level, exactly how some of these textbooks contradict themselves in their own terminology, and how there is this kind of a subtle anti-supernaturalistic bias, and that everything is viewed from the evolutionary point of view. It is not viewed from the point of view of the Bible. Why do we assume the Bible and science do not harmonize? I have said time and again that true science, provable science, measurable, ascertainable science, and the Bible do not contradict each other. The Bible, believe it or not, allows for vast aeons of time, billions of years, if scientists would like, whatever they'd like. Would they like 4.5 billion? That has been quoted time and again as the most accurate age for the history of the earth. Fine, the Bible allows that. What about 20 billion? Would they like to say 150 billion? Fine, the Bible allows that. There is room in the description of the original creation, then its subsequent destruction, and then its reorganization and a creation where mankind is put upon the scene. There is room in that vast indeterminate period of time for there having been billions of aeons and any number up to dozens of different inundations of the entirety of the continental land masses of this earth. The Bible speaks of one distinct inundation prior to the time of what is called normally creation week. Then it speaks of another great inundation, which practically everybody scoffs at today, the Noachian flood. Now, last time, I was saying, isn't it strange how Jesus Christ of Nazareth, you know, you've heard that name before. Well, it's a name that's bandied about that almost nobody pays any attention to when it gets around to what he said, what he ordered, what he commanded, what he did. As far as living the way he lived, admitting that what he said was true, and obeying his orders, that's another subject. But at least people do appropriate his name. But isn't it strange how he went out of his way, it seems, to pick upon those parts of the Old Testament that most people call myth today? Here he quoted what had happened at Sodom and Gomorrah. He said, remember Lot's wife. He talked about the Garden of Eden and creation, how it's evident that he which created first made them male and female. He gave this as an example about marriage laws and so on. He went out of his way, it seems, to single out those events of the Old Testament that scholars, yes, even biblical scholars, they like to call themselves, I understand a great big controversy starting to rage in one of the mainstream Christian religions these days over whether or not the Bible is really accurately true or whether you should interpret it all different ways. So Christ himself believed in the Garden of Eden. I recently heard a talk show narrator say, now you don't believe in all that stuff about the Garden of Eden, do you? We're chic. We're up to the moment. We're really enlightened today. We don't believe coal is really down there, do we? Do we believe coal is really down there? How'd it get there? Jesus believed in the Garden of Eden. He believed in the Noachian deluge and talked about it. He believed in Jonah. Yeah, the story of Jonah, and even talked about the exact precise limit of time he was in the belly of a great fish, and said that was exactly the limit of time Jesus would be in the heart of the earth, dead, 3 days and 3 nights. So the Jesus Christ of Nazareth that many people try to appropriate for their own and say, oh, I believe on him, but they don't believe what he said, went out of his way to single out those events of the Old Testament of your Bible that most Christian professing people call myth. In a moment, I'll show you, by taking just those fossil fuel sources, and one in particular, that you can prove there was a vast inundation, not once but maybe several times, of every great land surface on this beautiful green earth.
One question that has bothered man for centuries probably has bothered you too. Average men and great philosophers alike have struggled with this monumental problem. And it's a question that needs answering. The question is, does God exist? And if so, how can you prove it? Whether you feel that organized religion is ritual or reality, the question still remains. The free booklet, Does God Exist?, offers tangible information that will help you answer this timeless question. You'll learn how matter, intelligence, and design prove the literal existence of a creator God. There is no greater question that means so much to your own daily life and peace of mind. Does God exist? Now you can know beyond any doubt. Request your free copy of Does God Exist? Dial this toll-free number, 800-423-4444. That's 800-423-4444.
When you first are ushered in on the scene, according to the biblical account now, not the evolutionary textbook, it begins with the same words that evolution does in the beginning. Evolution says, in the beginning was the hydrogen atom. You read in your Bible, in the beginning, God, and then the word created. Of course, I suppose evolution should spell the hydrogen atom with a capital H. They admit to natural laws, natural forces, natural energies, and all this type of thing, but they do not admit that there having been any divine cause for it. When you read what the Bible says in the first beginning few verses, it has one word which the commentaries, I have a biblical commentary here with me, admit is capable of several translations. It reads this way, in the beginning, God, the Hebrew word here was Elohim, E-L-O-H-I-M, and that is a plural word. It means more than one. Elohim, God, because it said down in verse 24 and elsewhere here, verse 20, where God is doing the speaking. And finally, when God said, let us make man in our image, in verse 26 of the first chapter of Genesis, and Elohim said, let us. It isn't an absent-minded God saying that there must be somebody else around. It's a plural word that means more than one. Jesus, believe it or not, was a member of the God family prior to his human birth. Now, that's a very heavily theological subject, you might say. Well, I don't know why it is, because it's the very first few verses of the whole Gospel of John, the very first few verses of the book of Hebrews, which plainly shows that. But it says here in the beginning, God, Elohim, more than one, the family of God, created the heaven and the earth. And the earth became without form and void. That's the original. I have a Bible commentary here that proves that, and you can prove it. You can look at modern translations, and you can look at the internal evidence of the Bible itself, which shows back in 1 Corinthians 14:33 that God is not the author of confusion, and the Hebrew words are tohu and bohu, that means in chaos, empty, vain, void, waste. Back in Isaiah 45 and verse 18, it uses those same words. So the internal evidence of the Bible itself is God created it not in vain, empty, and waste. The same words as appear here in the first and second verses of Genesis 1. So the correct rendering is that it became chaotic, void, and waste. Let me give you one quotation out of a biblical commentary. They try to be very wordy in these things, but it does show in this, and this is the Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown called Critical and Experimental Commentary. And it's a pretty book and all this. There's a whole series of them for all the books in the Bible. This is under the article on the geological portion of Genesis 1. And it says, it would be easy to show by analysis of the effects produced by a succession of catastrophes that they all tended to one definite end. So here is a biblical commentary that is admitting to geological evidence of a succession of catastrophes that all tended toward one definite end, that is, the final adaptation of the earth as a dwelling place for the human race and its contemporaneous tribes. Then it goes on about the Carboniferous period. Now, when you see the creation story of Genesis 1, it says at the latter part of that second verse of the Bible that the Spirit of God brooded over the face of the waters. Then a little later on in verse 9, it said that God said, "Let the dry land appear." So at some time after the creation of the earth and before the beginning of that creation week, the continents of this earth were covered with water. Was there, this is a theological question, I suppose, for some people, but it's not for me because it's a geological question. Was there a pre-Adamic world in which there were teeming millions or billions of life forms on this earth, a virtual subtropical climate over the entirety of the earth, different climatic patterns than we have today? I believe the Bible shows there was, and I believe that all of geology proves there was. Now, isn't it fortunate that our earth is just exactly the right distance from the sun? Isn't that lucky? Isn't it fortunate that our land masses are separated just the way they are? Isn't it fortunate the oceans are just as deep as they are and no deeper? And that the land masses are as high as they are and no higher? That the weather patterns are the way they are, that the currents of the ocean are the way they are, the till of the earth is just so, the polar ice cap storing all of that water up there that once maybe had been somewhere else. Isn't it a great blessing that somehow beneath the rocks under our feet is the stored energy of millennia ago that is there for the use of mankind today? Isn't that wonderful that we can burn it, that we can derive all sorts of energy forms from it, that chemists and scientists can make nylons and building materials and all sorts of synthetics from coal? What about coal? Just to zero in on one kind of a rock. They call it a rock. It isn't really a rock. Here's the article in the World Book Encyclopedia about coal. It talks about how it's called sometimes buried sunshine. Then it goes on about how coal was formed. You can look it up in a World Book Encyclopedia if you would like. But it tells you how, if you look closely at a piece of coal, you may be able to see markings on it. But at the same time, it tells you that it is formed by plants rotting, turning into a substance called peat that looks like rotted wood. After a while, it goes on, wide areas of the earth's surface sank. Streams and oceans poured in. Streams and oceans poured in, carrying mud and sand which covered the peat. The pressure of the water above squeezed down the mass of peat and gradually formed it into coal. Gradually. Did that happen gradually? Not so long ago, I was wading around on a beach picking up mussels and looking at the bright, beautiful sunshine up in Ontario in Canada. And here's the gentle lapping of the waves disturbed the little sediments there gathered at the shore of this lake. I looked, and here were these perfect leaf forms, but they were just the outline, and most of the substance of the leaf was gone. Now, you and I both know that water dissolves things, that the action of waves disturbs, sorts, shifts, and sometimes disintegrates things. What you have here in the coal beds beneath our feet and all over the United States and around the world is proof of a giant catastrophe. In a moment, I'll show you just how big a catastrophe this had to be. And I'm not talking now from any biblical point of view. This isn't some strange doctrine I found back in 1 Hephzibah 13:4 or somewhere. We're just talking about geology, about what everybody knows if they want to take the trouble to look into it, what you can prove in encyclopedias and geology textbooks, and how that absolutely demonstrates, beyond the faintest shadow of a doubt, gigantic global catastrophes, not just little streams and shifting tides on the shores of lakes.
A nation is only as strong as its families. If our nation were as strong as your family, how strong would it be? And if relationships in your family are not what you would like, where can you go for help? Plain Truth, a publication of understanding, is concerned. Every Plain Truth brings you helpful articles on how relationships can be strengthened between husband and wife, parents and children, families and neighbors, with interesting and useful information on helping your child enjoy learning at home and school, budgeting and sensible use of credit, preventing teenage depression, household health and safety, homemaking tips for the working mother, achieving full human potential, coping with inflation. Plain Truth emphasizes quality in all aspects of daily living. Let Plain Truth help strengthen your family and nation. Request your free subscription today. Dial this toll-free number, 800-423-4444. That's 800-423-4444.
Coal beds are found all over the Rocky Mountains of the United States, the Appalachian Mountains, and in many other parts of the United States, and, of course, around the world. Now, we're beginning to wonder about how many tons of coal there really are down there in reserve. But here's a chart that shows you pretty much the way an average coal seam may be found under the surface of the earth. You've got topsoil, and then sandstone, shale, sandstone, limestone, shale, and so on. All these really are the silts and the muds that were carried in by water, waterborne, water deposited, laid down gradually as one turgid, roiled mass, and this suggests a vast tidal action, not a stream bed under any wild stretch of anybody's imagination. There are no new coal beds being formed today. There are some very soft, peat-like coal areas being formed, a very cheap coal, but nothing at all of this kind of mass. Now let me show you a little bit about this. It takes anywhere from 5 to 8 feet, 5 to 8 feet. Now Wilt Chamberlain, world famous basketball star, is just over 7 feet. So it takes anywhere from the height of a 5-foot man to a foot over the top of his head of vegetable material, a mass of crushed, tangled, ripped up, disjointed, uprooted, decaying vegetable material to be crushed under the tons of silts, muds, and so on that became our limestones because of the lime content, our shales when they were very, very fine, and they were compressed by the weight and so on, very hard rock and very stratified, if you've ever gone out and seen it. And, of course, the sandstones that are so common on the Earth's surface, all these called sedimentary rocks, meaning they were laid down by water. But some coal seams can be 5, 8, 20, and 30 feet thick. Now, if it takes 5 to 8 feet of vegetable matter to even form 1 foot of coal, and it does, that's scientific. That's what the coal industry will tell you. Then how many feet did it take to form one 10 feet thick? Oh, about 80. About 80 feet, huh? You know, that's an awful lot of front yards, isn't it? That's a pretty big storm, wouldn't you say? Isn't that bigger than almost any flood you ever heard of in your wildest nightmares, and even any flood that you ever heard of in the classroom? Did you ever hear of a flood? Let me ask you this. When you went to school, did anybody ever tell you of a flood that was so disastrous that it ripped up so many front yards and so many farmers' vegetable patches and so many acres of forest that it piled up great, huge, floating rafts of vegetable material, uprooted them, because the coal, remember, shows the imprints of pine trees, of leaves and ferns, and that's quite common in coal. Bituminous coal, anthracite is the hardest and usually buried deeper. Did you ever hear in your education of a great catastrophe, a great flood, a great storm that was big enough to bury rafts of floating vegetable material that may have been something like, say, 80 miles long, by 40 miles wide, by about 80 feet thick. Boy, wouldn't that have been a flood? But you know, the proof is right there under our feet. The coal industry can tell you that. Let's see if I have that map right here. You take a look at a map of the United States, and for that matter, much of the world, and you see, where is the coal? It can be anywhere. It's in the Mississippi Valley, and it's up in the Rocky Mountains. The point is this. I don't believe that the continental North American land mass was beneath the surface of ancient seas just because I found some picky little scripture somewhere way back in the Bible where I discovered it said, one day a big flood came. See, I don't have to believe in the flood of Noah because the Bible tells me so. I believe in many things that the Bible tells me. Why? Because I have been able to go out and look at the rocks under my feet and look at the tools of science, and I have been able to measure and observe and weigh and begin to study these things to absolutely prove that the Word of God is factual, scientifically accurate, and you can do the same thing. Now, I believe it because the demonstrated proof exist unto the hundreds of billions of tons of evidence. You write for this booklet, Does God Exist? Free of charge, there is no price. Can you prove by looking at that which does exist, by looking at tangible laws, not guesswork now, I'm talking about scientifically proved and demonstrated laws which you can see, that you can touch, that you can understand with your own finite mind. Can you prove there is a God in the same way that science proves there is such a thing as an atom? Can you prove there is a God in the same way you can prove there is such a thing as electricity? Can you prove there is a God in the same way you can prove there is such a thing as air? You don't see air, you don't see electricity, you can't see atoms. You can only see what they do. Well, there are seven proofs God exists. Now, this booklet that we'll send you by return mail free of charge shows you these are not guesses, but factual proofs. It's not a weighty booklet. It's a very short, very brief booklet that I imagine you can read in less than 20 minutes. It's just that simple. You look all around you at the miracles, it seems, that man has wrought. The space age, technology, science, the fabulous day in which we live of jet travel and of space travel even. And then yet, on the other hand, you take a look at the common cold and the flus, all the diseases and aches and pains that plague us. Arthritis and multiple sclerosis and muscular dystrophy and cancer of the lung and of the throat and cancer of the lips and cancer of the skin, leukemia, heart disease, all the killers of human beings. On the one hand, we seem to be able to send men to the moon, and on the other hand, we can't relieve the aches and the pains of human beings here below. Man has a great mind. I mean man collectively. I mean man in all of his history. But man still doesn't know how to deal with some of the problems that are brought upon him by breaking of what seems to be natural laws. We still don't know how to get rid of the penalties that come upon us by breaking of laws. The whole question of whether or not God exists revolves around man's mind, man's ingenuity, man's creativity, and whether or not we are in some ways truly limited. You need to write for the booklet, Does God Exist? All you need to do to receive this booklet is to give us the call letters of your station. We'd like that. If you would, please, the call letters of your radio station. While you're at it, why don't you request the current number of the Plain Truth and find that there is a solution beyond human understanding. And we talk in the Plain Truth plainly even about Bible prophecy and about an ultimate solution beyond the acknowledgement of today's news media, because they simply do not acknowledge God or Bible prophecy. And that's what you will read in the Plain Truth. It is Plain Truth, straight from the shoulder, plain talk. I hope you'll write for it. We'll send it to you by return mail as soon as you dial that toll-free number, 800-423-4444. Or you can write to me, Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow with Garner Ted Armstrong, sponsored by the Worldwide Church of God. For literature offered on this program, send your requests along with the call letters of this station to Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, 91123. Or you may dial this toll-free number, 800-423-4444.